All right, I'm hoping everybody can see my screen.
Yes.
All right, cool. All right, so thanks for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to join you today. It's been a lovely service so far. I look forward to the rest of it. I'm gonna talk to you today about what I do for a living, and maybe some thoughts about what I do for a living. Of course, welcome your thoughts, your reactions, your questions. When I'm sharing screen, I have a hard time seeing those. So I guess put them in chat or save them to the end. It's unfortunately not as cool as if I was there in person, but we'll soldier on. All right. So let's see. All right, so first I'll start by telling you a little bit about myself. I grew up in Los Angeles, in LA, in the 60s and 70s, and this was the era of the space race when we were trying to get to the moon. And so I read a lot of science fiction. A lot of it was about space travel, about encountering new worlds, and nowadays a lot of future stories about the future are dystopias, but really, well, I don't know, when I was a kid, there were a lot of utopias, a lot of optimism. And I was swept up by that, shall we say. I went to school in Portland at Reed College, and I ended up studying physics. I took an astronomy class and astrophysics class, and I realized that I wasn't probably going to be able to go to the stars. But physics is a study of motion, of heat, and other sort of basic things. And so I took that knowledge and I decided to study not other planets, but our planet. So I went back east to Princeton and got a PhD at a NOAA lab, actually, a NOAA lab that's associated with Princeton, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency. Where I studied geophysical fluid dynamics. It's just a fancy way of saying meteorology and oceanography together. And I ended up studying the Arctic Ocean there. So there's sort of ocean symbols and an ice cube melting. I came to Seattle because back in Princeton, pretty much everybody was studying the Earth through computer simulation. And, that's nice and everything, but I kind of got bored with that. So I wanted to do field work to get out into the field. And the University of Washington is big on that. It's a really big center for physical oceanography. That means oceanographers whose first degree was in physics. We study ocean waves and warming and sea level rise and ice and things like that. So I still work with people who do computer simulations. And I also do field work. So here's my favorite view of the world, looking down from the top at the Arctic Ocean with the North Pole in the middle. And it's almost completely surrounded by land, actually, by North America, Greenland, and Eurasia. This black line shows you where the ocean is 500 meters deep. So outside of the line, it's shallower. It's these broad continental shelves. And inside, it's the deep ocean. And for 500 meters is what? Well, it's a little over 1,500 feet multiplied by 3. And so there's one deep connection with the rest of the world ocean, and that's called Fram Strait, connects to the North Atlantic Ocean. And then, of course, between Alaska and Russia, there's the Bering Strait, which is much shallower, connects to the North Pacific Ocean. A very important thing about the Arctic Ocean is that it's relatively fresh at the surface. There's a lot of rivers that flow into the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean is like a big estuary. It's like a big version of Puget Sound. But the difference is that it's sort of chilly up there. And because it's cold, we have to talk about ice. So here is a picture of a lake. Maybe it's a lake in the Cascades or the Olympics during the wintertime. The air is so cold it froze the surface of the water to ice. We call that lake ice. The Arctic Ocean is like a big salty lake. It's the air is really cold up there too, and it freezes the surface of the ocean into something we call sea ice, ice from the sea. And it's a little bit salty. The ice is a little bit salty. Sometimes the wind blows and it cracks open the ice cover. And so you see that meandering dark zigzag line. That's the water that you can see underneath the ice. It cracked open. We call that a lead because it leads you along if you're in a boat. So we're going to have some fun now. I have a few questions for the audience. How thick do you think sea ice is on average over the whole Arctic Ocean? Do you think it's 5 centimeters thick? I'm going to use scientific units here. Is it 5 centimeters thick? Is it 2 meters thick? Is it 4 kilometers thick? So you can think in your head, and I'm going to show you the next slide the answer. All right? So get your answer ready in your head. And it's 2 meters thick. So it used to be thicker, and we're going to talk about why in a minute. Maybe it used to be about 4 or 5 meters thick on average. Now it's 2 meters thick. It's actually probably less than that by now. It's not 4 kilometers thick. If you're thinking about that number, it's probably you're thinking about Greenland or Antarctica, where there's tons and tons of ice on the land. But that's not what we're talking about here. So sea ice is melting in the Arctic. Here is a satellite picture that was taken in the end of summer, September, in 1979. That's the first year we had these good satellites that could take this kind of picture. And here it is last September, much less. And so here is a time series on the extent in million square kilometers on the left axis there. And it just shows how year after year in September, the extent of ice is going down. This is this one's through 2016. It's about half of Washington State per year. And you can see there's lots of wiggles. It goes up and down, but generally kind of declining. So why is sea ice melting? Probably you can all guess the answer. Global warming. So here is a picture of one version of a picture of global warming. It shows the air temperature change, surface air temperature change over the planet from 1951 to last year. And where it's red or yellow or orange, that means it's warming. There's a few blue spots or white spots, but generally it's a red picture. So generally the Earth is warming. So why is the Earth warming? And probably you guys know the answer to that question too. But I'm not going to answer that right now. I'm going to talk about something else, something called the greenhouse effect. So the greenhouse effect is this. The sun beats down on the surface of our planet and warms it up. And that heat energy, that infrared IR energy, radiates back to outer space. And if there was no atmosphere on the Earth, it would just pretty much all go back to outer space. But there is an atmosphere. There's clouds and GHGs, greenhouse gases, that tend to trap some of that heat energy and push it back down to the surface. So in effect, instead of one arrow coming back, coming down to the surface, there's 2 arrows. That's the greenhouse effect. What are these greenhouse gases? The most important ones are water, carbon dioxide, and methane. And these 3 little pictures I've got here, there's no humans involved, right? It's just water evaporating from a lake or the ocean. There's carbon dioxide from a lot of sources. Here I have the Lion King roaring, you know, and there's carbon dioxide coming out of his mouth. And there's a swamp there, and there's methane coming out of that swamp. So no humans involved there. This effect makes our planet 30 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be otherwise. 30 degrees Celsius, that's almost 60 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it would be otherwise. This is a natural effect that has nothing to do with humans, all right? This is just how our planet works. But then there's global warming. Global warming is more of the greenhouse gases. So it's more of those orange wiggly arrows. The second downward arrow is bigger than it used to be. And so here, it's basically the same thing, right? I mean, we're basically enhancing a natural thing, this global warming. So, but instead of the natural sources, we've got carbon dioxide from like driving our cars. We've got methane from agriculture, like rice paddies. There's also freons from aerosol spray that we did put a limit on in the last few decades. And there's also water. We're not necessarily putting more water into the atmosphere, but because of those other things, we're warming up the atmosphere, and that enhances evaporation. So yeah, we're also sort of indirectly putting more water into the atmosphere. Now, all of these things have warmed up the planet about 1 degree Celsius over the past 100 years. Remember I said the natural thing is about 30 degrees Celsius. We've done about 1 degree Celsius. Well, and I can't say that we've done all of that. We have seen the planet warm about 1 degree Celsius, but how much of that is natural? How much of that, just natural variability? How much of that is caused by us? That's a harder question to answer, but the best guess right now is at least half, probably more, is caused by us. Now, maybe you drive an electric car. Awesome. So does that mean that you're not contributing to global warming? And so here I have another little quiz for everybody. In Mount Vernon, what is the number one source of electricity? Is it fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas? Is it hydroelectric, or is it wind? So think to yourself what you think the answer might be, and I'll show you next. Here we go. Sadly, it's fossil fuels. Unless my research is wrong, I think you're getting your electricity from Puget Sound Energy, PSE, and here is their electricity distribution from 2019. Coal 35%, natural gas 31%, hydro 23%, et cetera. They have said that they want to, reduce their use of carbon fuel. And so that's a good thing. Maybe we can all help them do that and maybe even do it faster. So to answer my question, if you're driving an electric car, are you doing a good thing for global warming? And the answer is yes, you are. Even in Mount Vernon, if you get your electricity is 66% fossil fuel, that's still not 100% fossil fuel. And so, yes, there's a recent paper that shows that in almost every place, not every place, but most places around the world, even if your electricity is partly generated by fossil fuels, you're still doing a good thing by driving your electric car. I want to show you a graph. I apologize if this is too scientific, but this is probably the most famous graph in all of climate science. So I thought, yeah, I should show it to you. And all it shows is pretty darn simple. It just shows carbon dioxide, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in ppm, parts per million, over the last number of decades in two places, in Hawaii and South Pole. And they do it in several other places around the world as well. And it just keeps going up and up and up. Over on the bottom left there, you can see I wrote that the maximum carbon dioxide over the previous nearly 1 million years was about 275. We know that from ice cores in Antarctica. And this is an old graph. We've basically gone above 400 now. This is the second most famous graph in climate science. So here, what we're going to do is we're going to take a computer and we're going to try to simulate what we already know is happening. Simulate the black line, the observations. Remember I said that there's been about a 1 degree Celsius warming over the past 100 years. So you can see that black line, more or less about 1 degree Celsius warming. Now you take a computer simulation and it's a simulation of climate. So you can sort of play with it like a toy. You can put in the anthropogenic, that's the human-caused greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide, et cetera, or you can take it out. When you take out those greenhouse gases and try to simulate the last 100 years, you don't get any warming. That's the blue there, the blue line there, the blue shaded thing. No warming. If you put in the greenhouse gases that humans have put in the atmosphere in your simulation, you can capture the observations. So 1 degree Celsius, big deal. 1 degree Celsius. Maybe tomorrow it's going to be 1 degree Celsius warmer or colder than it was today in Mount Vernon. But 1 degree Celsius averaged over the planet, averaged over a few years, can make a big difference. Here I am showing you a picture. It's a picture of a guy with a dog sled on a frozen lake somewhere. It's black and white. It's a little fuzzy. It's a long time ago. It's about 100 years ago. Where do you think this picture was taken? In your minds, think about the answer. Where do you think this picture was taken? And the answer is, are you ready? Green Lake. Green Lake in Seattle, Washington, on December 15th, 1919. So this was an unusually cold year. That's why they took a picture, got in the paper. But this kind of thing did happen with more frequency in the past. 1 degree Celsius cooler on average. And I'm not going to show you. Sometimes I show like plots that show what the temperature was like during ice ages. It was a few degrees Celsius colder during the dinosaur era. It was a few degrees warmer than Celsius warmer than now. So that's why we are concerned. Now, I showed you this picture before, this global warming picture. I didn't point out the red stuff at the top. The Arctic is warming faster than any other place in the world. Why? It's because the Arctic is covered with white stuff, with snow and ice. And, you know, if on a hot day, you know you want to wear maybe white clothing, right? Because it more easily reflects the sunlight. It limits the absorption of heat from the sun. And that's what's happening. That's what usually happens in the Arctic. But with global warming, we've got melting, and that snowy, icy surface is exposing darker stuff underneath. So in this case, it's exposing the dark ocean underneath. I could also show you a picture of snow that's melting and exposing dirt, just land, which is also darker. So what happens is that when you expose the dark stuff, it absorbs more sunlight, which then melts the ice and snow, which then absorbs the dark stuff, absorbs more sunlight, et cetera. You could call it a snowball effect. We call it a positive feedback. It's an amplifying effect. Okay, so this book was mentioned earlier. You know, when I started in this field in 1987, we knew this theoretically. And we wrote proposals to the National Science Foundation, to NASA, et cetera, saying, you should fund our research because, maybe something is going to happen in the Arctic. But we sort of half believed it and half didn't believe it. Maybe there were other things that we weren't aware of that would counteract this effect. No, it turns out it has all come true, sadly. And this book by my colleague, Mark Serez, Mark works at the University of Colorado. He's about my age. And so during my lifetime and Mark's lifetime in our careers, our field has changed. We started out and we were sort of exploration scientists, like, let's go over to this part of the Arctic and measure something. And when we do that, okay, now we know what that looks like. Now we've got to go somewhere else. We're just explorers. And we kind of figured, we'll go over there and measure it. Then we don't have to measure it again for a while. And we'll go somewhere else. And we'll go somewhere else. But now we realize with the change that's happening, no, that's no longer what we need to do. What we need to do is just sit in various places and measure year after year after year to see this change. So this book is not really about Arctic science. It's not about the news or anything like that. It's really about how we got our minds around, we meaning our climate scientists, Arctic climate scientists, got our minds around how to study this very rapidly changing environment. Yeah, all right, so I want to end by just showing you some cool pictures from the Arctic. One of the projects I have is flying around and measuring stuff from a C-130 airplane. So the reason I'm doing this is because when ice melts, it exposes, sea ice melts, it exposes the ocean to the sun during the summertime. Now, that's sort of a normal thing for regular oceans, but in the Arctic, this ice didn't really melt very much in the past. Now it's melting. It's exposing open water to the sun. It's getting warmer than it used to get. And I want to measure that. We can measure it by satellite, but the problem is we don't necessarily trust what the satellite is telling us. Satellites have trouble seeing through clouds. Some kind of satellites do that. And then also we want to know what's happening below the surface. So I published the paper that made this graph, you know, that said the Arctic is warming. I immediately acquired my own climate crank, who over the course of 7 or 8 months wrote me many emails, registered letters to the dean of the school, to the president of the university, saying that I was clearly lying, that the Arctic Ocean was warming. In the end, he promised or he threatened to bring me to the attention of Fox News, which I was kind of looking forward to, actually, but it never happened. I actually went to see a lawyer because I was kind of concerned, and the lawyer said, just wait for it to blow over, which luckily it did. But and, you know, this was just my limited exposure. There are other climate scientists who have this problem a lot more than I do, honestly. So I want to measure the Arctic Ocean and its warming. And what I do is I build these buoys, these surface drifting buoys. I call them up-tempo buoys, upper temperature of the polar oceans. I have a friend who's into jazz music, and he helped me name them. And really, it's just a floating ball with electronics, batteries, and a satellite antenna and GPS, and then a string of thermometers hanging down into the ocean. And one way we deploy them is with the Alaska Coast Guard, the U.S. Coast Guard based in Kodiak, Alaska. We fly up to Kodiak, and then we fly across the state of Alaska up to the Arctic Ocean. Here's what the hangar looks like in Kodiak. It's it can actually fit four of these C-130 airplanes in there. And here is me standing next to my buoy. It's pretty big. I'll tell you later, I'm working on making them smaller. So here's what it looks like when we deploy. This is actually the first one we deployed. And so this is a series, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F. And so what we do is they shove them out the back of the plane. There's a parachute and a little bag on the top of the box, and it's hooked up to the back of the plane with a line. It's called a static line. So when the box gets far enough away from the plane, it pulls the parachute open. And so the box just gets shoved into space, and the static line pulls the parachute open, and then it floats down to the surface. So I don't know if you can see that orange and white parachute opened up, and it floats down to the surface. It floats down to the surface, and then it's really just in a cardboard box. And so after a little while, it gets wet, and the buoy just kind of just plops out of the cardboard box and starts taking measurements and sending the data to me. Starts sending the data to me by satellite phone. So I have some new projects. I have one project where I'm going to try to make them smaller. I'm already working with somebody, and we're making a prototype version of my buoy literally out of a 1 liter Nalgene water bottle. So it won't last as long, but smaller is better. We'll be able to make more of them. And then over on the right, you can see I'm also trying to make them out of more eco-friendly materials, which is important to me. And that is all I have. Thank you very much.